This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize.
All right. Well, happy Friday, everyone, and welcome. You've landed in the TGIF DTRA DCT podcast, and we're going to get started just in a couple of minutes. I want to just reinforce that the D is now digital, which includes decentralized trials and goes a little bit further. And this is where we talk about all things digital trials and DCTs, and where our audience sets the topics. We try to meet a couple of Fridays every month at noon Eastern for an hour, and then the recordings are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms like Apple, Spotify, Google. And let's just take a minute and set the room. So here I am in NorCal, and Carl doesn't know what to do with himself. It's June gloom time in San Francisco, if you're familiar. So he's kind of offshore, but I can see him out there. It's pretty nice. And Jean, how are you doing today?
I'm great. It's a nice early summer day and looking forward to a really important story that Rachel's going to share. I'm really compelled by this one. Find it fascinating.
And Rachel, where in the world are you?
Hi, I sit in Woodbury, Connecticut. So honestly, it's hot and humid here today. So it's not my favorite weather.
I got it. Our other two typical regular co-hosts and co-leaders are actually in China doing something really exciting. And we might get to talk about it here later this year. I'm not really sure, but I'm having a little FOMO thinking about the things that they're doing. And I know I'll get the stories later, so I'm excited to hear about it. Oh, we've got some more people joining, so this is perfect. So today, I am very pleased to welcome Rachel McGovern from Boehringer Ingelheim to join us. I had the pleasure of listening to Rachel talk about what it's like to kind of, I'll say, test drive a protocol before you get it started at Scope this year. And I was super excited by the story. I've tried it in a couple different ways. Her way was a little different. And so she was kind enough to agree to join Jean and me today and share her story here. No slides, just conversation. So before we get going, Rachel, how about you tell a little bit about yourself, your backstory, where you've been, and what you're doing now?
Sure. Thank you. So again, Rachel McGovern, I'm currently a clinical development operations lead at Boehringer Ingelheim. I've been here for almost 4 years. Before that, I'll give you more about my Boehringer, but before that, I worked at Purdue Pharma in mostly CNS, especially pain. And then I spent the majority of my career at Bristol-Myers Squibb. And there I was in the lab for about 10 years. I have a BS in biology, loved working in the lab. And then I went to clinical operations. I was afforded that opportunity, worked in infectious diseases on an awesome HIV product, and then worked in oncology, both solid and wet tumor. And so that's where I have mostly phase 2-3 experience. Purdue, as I mentioned, was all CNS. I got a lot of phase 1 and phase 4 experience and did some really interesting things because I worked at Purdue during the pandemic. So I got to work under like the monograph and worked on emergency use authorization for betadine as a hand scrub, things like that, which were you don't you wouldn't I wouldn't get the opportunity probably, except for those circumstances. And then came to Boehringer because I love the clinical development operations lead role. So I sit at the program level, responsible for all of the operational execution of the trials underneath me. It could be an indication, it could be a program, it could be multiple programs or indications depending on size and scope. I started in mental health and we were working on major depressive disorder. The compound was actually being looked at for a few other indications as well. And then, I mean, I can go into all the details, but the trials unfortunately were not positive. And so I moved over to cardiorenal metabolic, or what we call CRM, about a year ago, last July. And so now I'm working on GLP-1. The indications are type 2D, all the pediatric trials, and some medical affairs trials as well. So that's me in a nutshell.
I'm going to double click just for a minute because parts of your journey feel like they're similar to mine. And what was it like for you moving from an oncology dominant background into mental health and CNS? And what surprised you as you made that shift?
Yes, that's a great question. Oncology has a different sort of feel to it in terms of why you're working on these drugs and, life-threatening situations and diseases. And mental health and health has a whole host of other reasons why we need to have better medications in this space. A challenge as an operational person is that in oncology, it's all objective endpoints. You can measure your tumor, you can measure other things, but mental health, it's all subjective endpoints. And so that was a real shift in mindset in terms of how to operationalize trials where your endpoints are pretty much how do you feel. So that was the biggest eye-opening thing for me. The people, the sites in mental health, they're also all about how you feel. So very supportive group, like very, I loved working in my NR2B team at Boehringer. They all have that psychologist, psychiatrist kind of feel to them. So that was fun for me as well, coming into the mental health space.
So I'm hearing empathy from
Yes.
right? I feel that shift that you described too, like the move from really objective to what I'll call more subjective endpoints is just tough for me. And it makes me really want more objective
Real
endpoints.
data. Well, it makes it really hard to get new drugs approved too. I mean, we're really struggling in the space, I think, to get new drugs on the market for people.
Yeah, that's a big old topic that I
That's
have a
it's a whole
feeling
other
I'm gonna.
hour session.
I'm sure, and we should just bookmark this now. Like, I'm sure we're gonna talk about digital endpoints and how the pathway needs to change and what signals we're getting at our annual meeting, which is the 5th and 6th of November in Cambridge. So just put a pin in that, and we're gonna come back to it. So, tell me about this idea of running a trial without running the trial. What first, how did you get this idea, and why did you think it was important?
So interestingly, it was my clinical program lead, Franco DiCrescenzo. So he's the sort of the medical person for, we have a lot of terms, right, and acronyms, but he's the medical person behind the protocol. I think they were at CNS Summit and he was talking to Dr. Elon Cohen, who works at the Hassman Research Institute. And they were talking about it. I remember I was on a site visit and they called me and asked, they started to talk about this. It was something they thought that we should do. And I had heard about it before. I sort of feel like other companies might do something like this, but nothing concrete. And I didn't have any real previous experience. And so they said, do you think we could, walk through our protocol, at Dr. Cohen's site? And I said, absolutely. One of the big things we were trying to really manage with our protocol was limiting the amount of time that patients are on site. Because in mental health, and especially in major depressive disorder, the longer time you spend, the potential for placebo effect. And so we were, so I said, yeah, I said, I didn't hesitate. For me, I was like, yes, we'll figure out how to make this work. We'll get this done. So that was the impetus for it, which was
So
exciting.
I'm just going to give some applause here that your clinician was the person who raised the topic. What do you think happened at the CNS summit that got him inspired to do that?
I mean, we had been, I don't know, I guess I wasn't there, but we had been talking about the protocol a lot. We had been talking about really making it lean. We had been talking about really, really decreasing the site and patient burden. And he and I were, lockstep in developing the protocol. So, we had a lot of operational conversations as well as scientific conversations. And we were very much about, minimizing the placebo effect. Dr. Cohen, presented at our investigator meeting on that. So it's something that's important to him as well, sort of minimizing the placebo effect. They have a paper published and things like that. So I have a feeling it was in our sort of trying to have a very simple and real world like trial, even though we were phase two, it came up like, how can we make sure that we actually did that? How can we actually verify that we do have an easier protocol, that it is easier for the sites? It hopefully will be easier for the patients as well.
So you were trying to mitigate the potential confounding variable of placebo effect
Yes. Yes.
by making this as least burdensome as possible to the patient.
And the idea that the least amount of time they spend on site is also hopefully a mitigation for that as well.
Yep. I'm following the logic, and I love that you were thinking about this during the design with the end in mind, right?
Yes.
But all protocols look fine on paper.
Absolutely.
Jean, chime
Yeah,
in.
I'm thinking about how do you actually simulate in that environment a participant's potential experiences. Like, did you have a mock patient? Were you just putting yourselves into the role of a patient? And are there, and this is because a purely naive question, are there measures for how to reduce bias in an environment like this, right? Where the psychological measurements are not, as you discussed earlier on, concrete and demonstrable and measurable. How did you simulate that piece? Because that I find fascinating. And we make a lot of assumptions, right? And that's I'd love to hear how you manage that piece.
Yeah, so what we I worked with the coordinator at the site, and we kind of came up with a plan, what could we do and what's possible. And so what we ended up doing was simulating or walking through, we call it now we're calling it a mock trial walkthrough. So we're walking through three different visits of the trial. We decided the screening visit, the baseline visit, because they're usually fairly intense and have a lot of different procedures in them and take quite some time. And then our study was short, for MDD or major depressive disorder, it's a 6 week trial, 6 weeks treatment. But our visit four had PK, so multiple PK draws. So we knew that would have some, time to it. So we decided we were going to walk through those three visits. I was going to be a patient. I talked to my MSL, my medical science liaison. He was super excited about it. He was a patient. And then the medical writer had also really been heavily involved with us in writing this protocol. And I thought for her, it would be a great experience because they're writing the protocols, they're writing the clinical trial reports, and I don't think they get the opportunity to visit sites very much. And so she was our third patient. So the three of us, so Boehringer people were the actual patients. And then we worked with the site to say, let's see, can we walk through the whole visit, or what parts could we actually put in place and simulate, and which parts do we just talk about? You had another part to your question, though, something about the bias. Okay, yes. So I can go back to also, how we did everything and what we did and kind of what we actually did simulate. But the bias part was also learning about at the site, how the site operates and how the site functions. And it's important for the PIs and the raters who are talking to the patients to have a certain, more of a clinical demeanor with patients, even though they're psychiatrists and they want their patients to feel better and to be better. They have to be a little bit more clinically oriented because it's a clinical trial and because of that placebo effect. So even little things like how does the person greet you when you come into the office? Like it's a very important. So you have to be a little bit more general with the patients. And then we learned that while sitting at the site and talking to them about how they approach their patients who are just their patients and how they approach their patients who are in clinical trials. So that's where they try to reduce the bias.
So really interesting nuance there, right? That
Yeah.
is the same applied outside of this space when it comes to how you're treating a patient in a clinical trial versus not, or
It
is
depends, I would
right?
say,
Yeah.
honestly. Like if you're
Yeah.
doing this, I'll just jut in for a sec. Like I'm thinking way back to my osteoporosis trials, and you had to ask the patient to complete all of their patient-reported outcomes before anything else happened so that you didn't influence the outcome of how they answered. And so in that way, Jean, I think it is meant to be a little bit neutral. Whether or not it's effective, I don't know. And there's this guy that we know who might have opinions on that, but he's away this week.
Yeah, no, I think it's important. So we'll come on
But
that.
normally you would want to greet your patient, right? You want
Right,
them to
of
come in, you
course.
want them to be there, you get greeted, you feel happy and comfortable being there, but it's a balance when you're treating someone with major depressive disorder and trying to measure how well the drug is working versus how well your interaction with the site is contributing to your maybe lesser depression.
Yeah, and it makes me think about the whole concepts around psychological safety and removing the fear factor, which inherently we want to do when we're talking
Of
with patients
course.
in any
Yes.
setting. So, yes,
Yes.
very complicated.
Yes, very much so.
So, you were
But I
going
am.
to do a walkthrough of three visits, and one of the visits included PK, and you weren't going to roll up your sleeve and do PK.
Correct. Correct.
But I'm assuming now that you were in a dose range type trial.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So where was the site where you were going to do the simulation, and what exactly did it take to get things set up?
Yep. So I met with the coordinator. We probably, okay, CNS Summit, I think, is in November.
Yes.
So the coordinator and I talked weekly or every other week for a couple of months. We actually did the simulation on March 4th. And
Okay.
that was related to our first patient first visit in, which was supposed to be sort of the end of March, if I remember correctly.
Oh.
And so I started to put down sort of just basically like, what's the goal? So, why do this, right? I will go into the cost if someone wants to. This is not was not expensive, but still, it's time away, it's people traveling, it's visiting. They were in New Jersey, so for me, it wasn't a big deal. Quick drive down. But the medical writer was from Germany, so she had to get permission to sort of fly over for this. So what's the primary goal? And then I put down like, what are the objectives? Like, what can we hope to achieve? What could the simulation include? Can we include everything? What might be ready in time in terms of the site level things? So we could go through the informed consent. We could go through simulating an ECG and a PK draw. We had, of course, reader stations and tablets. So, and Echo devices. So can we kind of run through those? Like we decided, yes, we're not getting our blood drawn. We didn't actually get the ECG done, but we could walk through at the site. And then over the course of our conversations, there were various action items. When would all our vendors be ready? Could we see the lab kits? Even though I wasn't getting my blood drawn, could we see the lab kits? Is the ECG machine there? Are the tablets there? There's two separate tablets. So we tried to go through that as much as possible. And so then it was more about, how much time do we need? How much time are we taking out of this site's day, right? This site who is doing other things, right? On this random Wednesday or whatever March 4th is. And so it was also, things like the informed consent. We talked about that as in a group, and then one person sort of went through that process. But they went through the entire informed consent process. I think I was the baseline visit, so I went through all of the rater stuff. I did the MADRS with them. I did the Hamilton. I did so I went We did go through all of the scales, that were going to be done in those visits.
I'm going to double click on something here just for a sec. So I'll come back to the thing I want. I'm assuming all of your site staff raters had to go through some sort of training to, yeah. Did they love that?
Reader training. Yes, you're correct. And by that point, they were supposed to start. And Dr. Cohen, I think, very much wanted to have the first patient. He was our coordinating investigator. So that was the question. So will everything be right? Will everybody be trained? Like, at least would they have the majority of the training? Do they like it? Okay. I'm not a rater. I'm not a rater. I can't answer, but I do think the training can be pretty intense sometimes. The people that have been rating for a long time, they're probably used to it. I think our learning in that case was that, if someone just was rater trained, 3 weeks ago for another trial, I have to make them do it again for mine. Is that really the best
Is
way to
that
do things? Could we be a little bit more efficient there and help save some time? Raider training takes a
a
while.
lot?
It takes a lot. Yeah. So, do they like it? I mean, I think those people kind of love what they do. Probably they know they're doing it for their patients, but the certifications and the training, and again, the more scales like that that you have, the more training they have to do, right? So if you can be a little leaner and not ask 15 scales, but just ask two or three, then maybe it helps minimize their training time.
So now here's the other question that you just set up. You said, hey, and there were two tablets. Say more about that, please.
Yeah, so I will, okay, I'll use generic names, right? So the trial was actually outsourced to one of our CRO partners. They were actually also at the simulation. So the CRA
Okay.
was there, and I'll give it away, but the SME was there. So they, because they would be assigned to the Dr. Cohen site, so they could all meet each other as well, a little bit of FaceTime before the protocol. They could also get a feel for the protocol. They were observing us. And so we realized a couple of things when we were there and preparing for the simulation or the mock trial walkthrough. The lab kits we heard were on site, and the coordinator didn't know it because someone else, got them and put them on the shelf and logged them in. So, finding all the pieces for the trial too was good. The tablets, so we had an eCOA tablet and we had the Raider station, which is also a tablet, both from the same vendor, both in the same box. And they were getting two of each because they would need a backup. And I think the coordinator didn't realize she almost returned one of the boxes thinking it was a duplicate. So we learned sort of little things like that to maybe give a heads up, like the CRAs can give a heads up in their pre-SIV call to say, do you have your lab kits and do you have two sets of tablets and have you plugged them in and are they charged and things like that. So yeah, I didn't even realize it until, because it's two different sort of companies in a way, part of the same overarching company, but the boxes look exactly the same with the tablets in them for the two different pieces of the trial.
I'm just sending a little love and empathy to all the CRAs in the world because I think it's such a difficult job.
And the coordinator, yeah, CRAs and because every trial has 25 of these things, right? It's not just the one trial they're managing and helping their sites with.
Jean, I'm sorry, I've hogged all.
And it's a dialogue. It's a dialogue. And so you probably answered a lot of the things I've been thinking about. Is what, was there any one thing that stood out as being the most challenging setting up the simulation? And then once you were in the simulation, were there any really surprises? I think you spoke about a few, but do they stand out? Anything stand out more than the other?
Setting it up was, I have to say, was easy. Like, it was not hard to set it up. It was not hard to work with the coordinator of the site to sort of figure out what we were going to do. Like, that part was really, I thought, went pretty well. And again, we did it in a couple months, so it wasn't so time consuming. The intention that we had was that we would go through in as patients and we would do all of the scales on the actual tablet that was going to be given to the patient, because that's something that, you do the user acceptance testing and you look at the tablet and you think it all makes sense. And so we really wanted to, I really wanted to simulate that. And I had done everything, I thought I had done everything to be prepared for that. So we all had individual subject IDs because, again, I couldn't interfere with our real patient data. So I needed to figure out how do we do this. And so everyone knows that these are fake patient data. This is not part of our real study data set. I missed a step in connecting like our subject IDs with the tablet. So when we got there, we couldn't find our IDs on the tablet. So I did miss a little step. So I did call the help desk. I did call the help desk because this is something that we hear that people, all the technology you have, there's different phone numbers and different help desk numbers, and there's different help desks. So I did call the help desk. And of course, I tried to explain what was happening. They probably didn't really, they weren't aware of my mock trial walkthrough, right? And so I did spend 25 minutes on the help desk with, zero resolution to my current problem at the time. So it was a little bit, and you talk about empathy, it was a little bit about feeling what sites go through when you have four, five, six, 10, 11, 12 vendors who all have their own help desk and their own challenges and a small little issue. Like, we did everything, I go into what we did as a mitigation, but a small little issue that you think, will hopefully take you 5 minutes. That was a half an hour out of your day. As a coordinator, that's a lot, and brings frustration and other things like that that then make your protocol maybe not so pleasant, or maybe people don't want to do your protocol. So.
Yeah, let me, one question on in alignment with that. So you had said that you had brought people from Boeing or that had typically not really spent any time at a site that were the people that design protocols and get them out there. Did they have any aha moments that, particularly you think, because we talk about simulating the patient experience, but in the process, you're simulating so many other experiences that have such a ripple effect downstream that was that part of the plan? Or do you think there's some message really for others to think about in the value of doing something like this?
Yeah, so I always say, and the medical writer and I chatted a lot, and she worked really hard to help us have a really clean protocol. And the coordinator did say, like, this was one of the best, I'm gonna toot my own horn, this was one of the better protocols. Like, she had a very small sticky of sort of questions. But I think the medical writer realized that when you write something in a protocol that sounds so clear or obvious or easy, it might not be so easy to operationalize at the site.
Right.
So I'm trying to think. I just had an example and it like flew out of my head. Oh, like the there was we had to do like a neurological physical exam, and I was worried because I was like, I didn't really know how we were doing it. I didn't know how every piece, it had 10 items, like how are they all going to be, like the gait and all. And so she's like, I ran through the neurological exam. She's like, it was took like 5 minutes, all good, had to touch my nose. Like, so she actually kind of got to see how some of that was
Oh, okay.
done at the site, so she can write about it. There was a couple other things that she realized. She spent a lot of time, I think, on making sure the text of the protocol was made sense and was traceable, because I think she thought everyone was going to look at the protocol in an electronic fashion. And she saw what the coordinator did. They have their own binder, the binder's labeled, they print it out, it's paper, they have like their little, this particular coordinator had her little tabs on there. So she's like, oh, so now in her head, she thought she might do things slightly differently, knowing that they're looking for things on paper versus electronically. So that was something that she, nice, thanks. I like the hearts. So that was something that she kind of took away from that. And then things, sometimes we get too prescriptive in our protocol. So we talked a lot about the procedures and what's done, especially at that visit four. So PK was, if I remember correctly, 30 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours. So now we know they're staying on site for at least 2 hours, and they have to do a whole bunch of stuff first. And so, if you get too prescriptive about the order that the site has to do things, now you've left out their flexibility, or you've made it maybe so that they actually can't do it without sort of a deviation. So she's learned that, when I put something in the protocol that says you have to do this, then this, then this, it isn't really that critical, and it takes away the flexibility from the site to manage their own site processes, which might be different from another site. So yeah, I think she loved it. She loved it. She loved being there. She said she had great learnings and would take all those back to her next protocols that she was working on.
One quick question, then I'll pass over to Jane because I know her mind is going. From the site perspective, when you first introduced the idea, any particular resistance, or were they really looking forward to having the opportunity to really highlight what it's like to run, a trial in that way?
So I mean, I'm the sponsor, right? So no, I didn't detect any resistance. This also did call, I think Dr. Cohen was part of this, so he probably could also talk to his staff about this. Now, like I said, like we didn't have 100% of our staff with us, but they had staff who were spending a serious amount of time with us, because we were on site from probably like 9 to 1 or 2, setting it up and running through. So it was, it had a cost to them. But no, I did not detect resistance from them at all. That was not something that I experienced at all.
You had an internal champion at the site. So that sounds like a
Yeah.
critical success factor.
And I think they all realized it too. So what a big learning at the site level was that we were now their first patient. So instead of a patient being their first patient, we were the ones that they can go through. They could make the little mistakes, figure things out, and it didn't have as big an impact, I think, on that first patient. So from my sense, they seemed to think it was great. I mean, I don't think they were just stroking my ego. I think they really did benefit from it, and they did actually have the first patient, screened on the trial, I think, a week or two later. It wasn't that much longer.
Actually, I know we have a couple sites in the audience, so it's the perfect
Excellent.
time to kind of invite the audience to raise their hands and ask questions. And I would actually invite you to come off mute if you want to ask your question. Betsy,
Yeah.
I got so many questions.
Okay, just
Be
get
careful
going,
letting me
right?
come off mute because I might take over here. Rachel, you may know, so I work for IQVIA. You may know my colleague Yvonne. Your name is familiar because I think we've done, I work in the group that does DIPA. If
I
I
worked
don't.
with, I call, I said Ivan. So yes, I
Yeah,
did do the deep, I say
yes.
DIPA. That's funny. I say DIPA. Yes,
Oh,
I'm
it's so funny. Yeah,
familiar
yeah.
with DIPA, and yes, I've did it
Yes,
for this
perfect.
trial.
Okay.
Yep.
But so my background is I spent 15 years at sites and I mean, I said in the chat, I just love this. I had so many trials where I wish we had done something like this because the last thing you want is to be sitting there figuring this out in front of a patient. It's hard on them, it's hard on the site,
Yeah.
it causes deviations. It's really not ideal. And so I'm curious if Boehringer or other sponsors that you're aware of are building this in as a routine step of activation, or was this a bit of a one-off? And then secondarily, I would love to see this happen sooner. So, I mean, it sounds like you were doing it at the point where the protocol was finalized,
Yep.
but from a design perspective, I'd rather identify those problems and mitigate them before the protocol is finalized. And so I'm curious if there's any appetite within Boehringer or others that you've talked to for doing this sort of work earlier in that design process.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Fantastic. Thanks
Yeah,
for
yeah.
asking a question. So it yes, it does seem to be a bit of a one-off, which I agree with you. I don't
Okay.
think it should be, but I don't think Boehringer, I did present this inside Boehringer. I presented it at Scope, so I'm glad we're talking about it. I can't say that Boehringer has fully adapted it, or that I'm aware of. And then you're absolutely correct. So the interesting thing about the timing is you have to figure out sort of when you're far enough along in the CTP development process that it makes sense, but not so far along that you can't make changes.
Yeah. This is
So,
a classic problem for us.
yeah, so we were lucky in a way that this trial was about to start. So you're right, we went there with an approved protocol. We were lucky in a way that we did a decent job, and I can give you my DIPA results. They were 24 on the burden score, and then after
Yeah.
this, they were 17, which I'm super
Okay.
happy with the 17,
Okay.
which is good
Nice.
for MDD. And then it should be, it should, so, but we had a second protocol coming too that wasn't done yet. So then we thought, okay, this will help us drive any
Yeah.
changes we need to make to that second sort of sister protocol. But you're absolutely right. I think it should be earlier. It's just that timing. So you'll have to maybe walk through different things because at some point your vendors won't be ready, depending on how early. So you just have to
Right,
balance, you
right,
know, walking through
right.
your procedures with maybe not all vendors ready, which could also be perfectly fine. So I
Yeah.
totally agree earlier. Earlier, before final protocol would be better.
Yeah, but then the other piece that you sort of started to think about, I think a little bit, is identifying trends. So if I take this learning from protocol A, how can I apply some of those learnings to protocols B, C, and D in my same program, or even universally across my company? So, yeah,
Right.
I'm curious. Did you guys do anything with that information that then? I mean, it sounds like you had another protocol coming out of the line, but inside of Boehringer, was there an appetite for institutionalizing that and applying that more broadly?
Yeah, I'll have to check because I did give a presentation in our patient insight engagement group. Like they do
Okay.
sort of monthly meetings, and I did
Yeah.
present about this to them. I'll have to go back and follow up. So no one's reached out to me to ask me about it inside Boehringer. So
Okay.
I don't
Okay.
know if someone has done it.
Yeah.
I think it's great if we were new in the like. So at, I should tell you, Boehringer at the time was new in CNS, was new in mental health. Like we didn't have a big, you know, spread out there. Also, Boehringer is not publicly traded, so we also wanted to be bigger in the space, and so that
Yeah.
was a benefit as well. And I thought, I do think this would help, like if you're in like a new indication or it's the first protocol and indication, you know, would you do, maybe you should do it for your fifth obesity trial though, if you have 8,000 things in there. So you know, I can
Yeah.
go either way, and it's what people,
Yeah.
what's the, where's the appetite for it? But in the grand scheme, it didn't take that much time. It didn't cost that much money. And
Yeah.
if we could be the first patient and lower patient burden, site burden for everyone else, then shouldn't we
Yeah.
consider that?
So,
Well, if you can prevent a protocol amendment within
yes.
the first 3 months, bonus, right?
Yeah.
And
There's hundreds of thousands of dollars right there. Yeah.
yeah.
we did one amendment, but that was to change our primary endpoint timing because of something we learned. But otherwise, we would not have had to amend the
Fair.
protocol.
That's
So
interesting.
we did a good job that way. Yeah.
So, Betsy, I'm chiming in because you and Justin met each other, but
We
Justin
don't.
other people don't know, last year Justin and one of Rachel's colleagues, Katrin Ong, were part of the team that I was on too,
Decentralized trials, right? Working with
working
us.
to figure out how might we set up simple processes, simple, I say, simple processes so that it's more clear how you could ask for this input from sites. Both before you finalize the protocol and then before you actually operationalize it. And specifically, we were thinking about using digital elements in trials. But I agree with both of you that this, it seems like it could be useful, and the insights don't seem to be shared broadly. So that's why I'm applauding you, Rachel, for sharing how you went about it and what you learned. Okay, enough from the soapbox. But Betsy, I think I cut you off. You had another
No,
question.
no, no. So one other piece of this, and obviously you guys are very focused on decentralized trials. I would imagine that if you were trying to identify these potential friction points in some of the more tech based components of a trial, there's sandboxes, there's UATs, like there's ways to preload that and make sure you can't. Now you're shaking your head, maybe not. I mean, in theory there are, but maybe not in practice.
They are there, but I don't know that they're ready early enough to Rachel's
Yeah.
point. And typically the UAT is done by the sponsor team.
Yeah, I did UAT for all the COAs. And I think I understand what you're saying. And yes, you can. I sat here and I made up data. I tried to figure out if I could break it. But when you're actually sitting at the site doing it, it feels a little different. So I mentioned I would say that because the tablets weren't ready, the site was super responsive and quick and printed everything out. So I'd still went through all the scales. We just had to do them on paper. And so, yeah, I don't know. You do the UAT and it's time constrained and you're trying to get through it. So I don't know, when I was doing UAT, I wasn't thinking of myself as the patient. I was just trying to make sure as a sponsor the UAT made sense and I could make sure test it out. And so I see what you're saying, Betsy, but there is something about sitting at the site. Maybe we just have a whole separate, walkthrough where we just go through scales. You don't do a whole visit, but you just kind of get things in play and outside of a protocol, just go through simulating scales and answering all those.
And again, coming from the site side, I remember a couple trials where there was a very specific order of operations that you had to, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this. You had to put your patient in IRT before you could load get a screening number in the EMR in order to, or in the EDC rather, and in order to get something loaded onto the tablet. And it sounds like you sort of run into some of this. And so, yeah, like if you're testing these systems individually, you're not going to know about that piece. And certainly when we were activating studies, that first patient was so key for figuring out what guidance I was going to give the rest of my coordinator team or whoever it was to know, okay, you have to do A before B before C. But I like the idea of doing it. I mean, obviously there's a UAT of like, does this tool work? But then does this work for sites and how does it fit into the larger environment? And maybe that needs to happen closer to that first patient's activation.
I think you said it really well. There are different reasons to do UAT. One is, I'll say, compliance and data rigor, right? Another is operational feasibility. But maybe different people do it. So that's a great idea. Jean, I
Yeah,
can see your wheels are turning.
I'm thinking. So we simulated a participant's experience, and we're all collecting data from potential participants as we get feedback on our protocols, and we solicit information from them throughout the course of the trial. There's lots of things we're trying to do to really engage with patients. Have we ever thought about really doing simulations with a potential participant? And I know the dynamics become equally more complicated, but we're already doing some of it, right? We talk to patients probably by TA area through patient engagement part, through across different enterprises. And I can remember having several information gathering sessions on specific protocols and procedures, but have we, and I can remember the people in HEOR coming and on trying to get more feedback on the actual process that we put in front of a patient while we're still planning. Again, it adds timelines, but is there a future where we should be thinking about it
Gosh, I
differently?
think there's a past where we did think about it, Jean.
And but to have yes, and
So this is
lessons
what I
learned.
meant when I said, and this is how I met Kimberly Kelson, who runs your patient engagement team.
Yes.
Once upon a time in another galaxy, I had the opportunity to work at a place where we stood up a physical space called the Imaginarium. The Imaginarium was like a site environment and had multiple rooms, and you could configure it in different ways. And when, especially if we were doing a new indication or something that was especially unfamiliar to us, or a very special patient population like pediatrics, we would set up the Imaginarium and bring in patient representatives as well as site representatives, like not a huge number, right? And usually the statistician, the clinician, not because we wanted them to literally walk through the schedule of assessments, but rather so they could see what was being asked of the site and the patient. That was a pretty significant investment. It was really, really helpful. It doesn't exist anymore, to my knowledge. Justin, good morning. It's so
Good
nice to see you.
morning. I had to look at the clock. It is still morning here in the Midwest. It's definitely morning for you out on the West Coast, I guess. But no, I just want to come off mute, and I love kind of the direction this conversation has gone, because that's really where my head was at, and my questions as Rachel was kind of talking, through their process here, was the whole question of like who is the right person to be doing this testing. And I think, when Betsy was talking, we kind of hit it on the head. Like there are different purposes for UAT, and it's probably a different person. We probably need multiple. Like we refer to UAT as one thing, but we probably need multiple rounds of it for multiple purposes and multiple stakeholders involved at each point. Obviously, then we run into the constraints of do we have the time and the buy-in to do all of those. But yeah, my big question was, I love that we're doing this, but at the end of the day, the participant is the one that we really need that lens of. And even a medical writer who's never been to a site before is still so much more familiar with the protocol, familiar with clinical research in general than a patient would be. So, my question is, how do we, get access and ability to put some of these things in front of patients? I'll say our one experience at Mayo with that. It was our very first trial that our team, helped an investigator, where like the whole trial was done in an eco environment. And so, our team worked very closely with the vendor through the whole build. We did the kind of the traditional UAT process. But then after we got through that, we turned around and handed it off and had the coordinators that were going to be, and we've got the luxury where we're kind of sitting, we are the site, and we're almost the sponsor in this circumstance, because it's an IIT. So we had access to all the stakeholders. So, but we had the coordinators work with, and then we lovingly refer to this as mom testing in our department, because this PI actually recruited her mother, and I think it was like her sister and one of her best friends, to come play patient for us, and spent weeks with our team, kind of, going through every phase of the trial and working with the coordinators, and we learned so much from it. But even, again, in our circumstance where we have the luxury of for IITs kind of having access to all these stick, we still try to figure out how are we going to scale that to other trials where we don't have a PI that's willing to recruit their mom. So I'm really curious to hear from, people that work or have worked on the sponsor side, how would we ever think about doing that, for a multi-site sponsored trial? Because yeah, we definitely saw the success, but I'm just struggling in my head to figure out how do we replicate that at that size of a trial.
We thought about whether we could do it with real patients, because we, like Boehringer, has, like patient advocates that we, work with. We were worried about the timing and getting them to do it. We didn't know if they'd commit. And then the whole, I mean, there is some liability issue too with some of this that you have to at least consider, especially for the sponsor and the site. We get patient feedback. We do a lot of patient things, and Branding Science does what they call a patient simulation, but that's where they actually put together storyboards about your study and interview patients for patients and I think coordinators for, you know, an hour or so about your protocol, but that's not the same thing. So I hear what you're saying. Somewhere out there, there's got to be advocacy groups who might have people who would be willing to sort of engage in something like this. I just don't know if I don't know if Behringer's gone down that road to sort of seek those folks out. Because even if they only walked through or simulated a few things, I think it would still give us valuable information about how it's being perceived by a typical, you know, patient, you know, coming into a trial.
Yeah, I think that's the key. You know, we don't have the time, or I'm just getting, you know, how do we even think about doing this? Like, okay, yeah. we don't have the time to do the full trial, but can we identify the key, what we think are maybe going to be the key pain points? And
yeah, where's the sticking points?
You
know, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there are commercial entities that can help with this. And then there are the patient advocacy groups within sponsor organizations. And then one thing that I saw tested that was kind of cool, oh, sort of a hybrid, ironically, Justin. In this big place I worked at before, we actually asked the people with conditions to raise their hand and say, would you be willing to provide insights knowing you're not going to get into the trial? Because that was another whole thing. Like if you go through the simulation with a person who's going to be in the trial, you may be adding bias. So we tried that out too. Mm-hmm. And of course we weren't going through physical procedures, but it was a way to test, are we adding too much complexity? Is this actually aligned to what patients would be willing to do? Is it what they think matters? So that was interesting, because to Rachel's point, and I'm going to ask you about this in a second, Rachel, there were some tricky legal bits that had to get sorted. So I was curious, Rachel, did that come up? Like, was there a contract that you had to sort through with the site and the, and what about your internal employees?
So I think they were okay. They got permission from their managers and things like that. There was, I don't remember like internally having sort of any issue, because, you know, we go to sites all the time. So that part was okay. Yeah. The site, I ended up talking to a few different individuals at the site level. So because Dr. Collin was an investigator for that, there was an investigator contract, right? A site contract. We talked about adding a few lines in there, as I mentioned, for liability purposes. Like, you know, God forbid, like I get hurt or a patient gets hurt, because we are walking through the site and we are new people at the site. So it's just in case something like that happened, you know, everyone was covered. And then it was not a lot, but we ended up adding it to the investigator site contract for the trial. That's how we did it, because we already had that in place. We added a few lines about liability and then about scope and then about, you know, cost or payment. They needed to be, you know, compensated for their time and efforts. That was the trickiest part. So what we ended up deciding to do is, because we were walking through three study visits, we actually paid them the equivalent of what they would have received for a patient going through those visits, with sort of a cap in terms of the maximum that this would cost. But at the time, there wasn't enough. I mean, if happy to hear if people have creative ideas, we didn't have sort of another way to really sort of figure out what to pay for the work that they were doing. So yeah, each, you know, screening, baseline, and the PK visit all had amounts already negotiated, because we were so close to starting. And so we just agreed, we'll just pay the equivalent of what you would get for the patient doing this visit. So that's how we did
that. That's a great solution. Betsy.
Yeah. So I'm thrilled to hear that you compensated them for their time. And I don't have a better idea than just paying them for the
budget. Or a way to structure it.
Yeah. But I do think there's a really interesting feedback loop there, that this is a chance for them to understand, does my negotiated budget cover my costs? And obviously there's more friction in the test than there will be on the 10th or 20th or 100th patient. But this is one more place where I would love to see this being done as early as possible, just to inform some of the budget that you offer people, that people negotiate. Like that, I want this so much for everybody.
Yeah, agreed.
Jean, did you have something you wanted to
Yeah,
ask?
I'm hesitating to go that route. I know how hard it is to embed a new process into anything. And if we're doing it at the study level, would there be any value in thinking about it even at the program level? Like just you're planning it all the way up front that if you know you're going to have new technologies or there's something very specific that you need to have that hands-on patient experience in, maybe the earlier you plan it in the overall programming, the less complex and the less arduous it becomes. It's a hope and a dream.
I'm with
I tend to throw out those hopes and dreams, but
you.
we're doing the same thing when it comes to reducing burden, full stop, across protocols. And we know if you just do it protocol by protocol, it's much harder to get teams to think about it. Whereas if we can start thinking about it, this is just becoming part of the normal process. But here are the criteria. It's a risk-based approach. Like, in which cases would this
Makes
be of
sense.
value? And then you have a measurable, because at the end of the day, if you don't, that's where we get stuck. And that's where the extra added burdens and complications come. Jane hates when I does this,
No,
but
it's so true.
ah!
When we
It's the
set up a
reality.
team with Justin,
Yes.
we defined a parameter. It's like, okay, how can you do this without adding more than 2 weeks to the protocol life cycle? Okay, because
Yeah.
that'll be hard to negotiate. Anything more than that, forget about
Exactly. But
it.
people forget there's a cost to
Everything, yeah.
there's a cost to having a difficult protocol. There's a
Oh,
cost to having a burdensome
absolutely.
protocol. Like, it's hard to measure that cost, but you know, and
Oh,
as soon as you're behind on recruitment, there's a cost to that,
of
right? And
course.
there's a cost to your, so I mean, I will say again, our protocol went well. We were a 6 months ahead of plan for a mental, and it was the first time in Boehringer for a mental health trial to be ahead of plan.
That's a good
And
metric.
so I didn't spend anything on additional recruitment measures, right? So you say, but it's hard to say what I saved because I didn't spend it, right? So I think
There
sometimes
are some
it's,
calculations out there.
oh, you
Sure.
saved 3 months
Yeah.
right there.
You can
That's
do the math on
unfortunate,
that one.
actually.
Yeah.
So, bravo
Yeah.
you.
So this simulation part or mock trial walkthrough didn't cost that much in terms of, I think, what we actually gained from it. So, you know, I tend to agree with you. I think I have to think about it now in CRM. I don't even know if they know about it. And you know, maybe there's a way to help people understand that every time you say, oh, it's just one little added thing. Well, all those one little added things or procedures sort of add up at the end of the day.
Yeah,
Talk
reducing
about this
off.
offline, Rachel, if you want to do a little case. I think that this is the kind of case study that needs to be shouted from the rooftops, not just at BI, but elsewhere.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And so that's actually a little put a pin in it because maybe we should talk about simulations at our annual meeting
I
in
think it'd be
November.
great.
Because Justin, you might have an opinion, right? Okay, last call for questions because I do want Rachel to tell us what changed from the experience of doing the walkthrough.
You want me to go before the questions? Okay. What changed in terms of the protocol? So I think not that much because we were final and we learned that we had a decent protocol. We did take a few things back for the second protocol to just sort of reorganize and rejig a few things. It was the same medical writer, so she could bring back everything she learned there. I think what fundamentally changed is your perception of actually sitting, of what it is to be a patient. And I can't even say I'm a full-blown patient, but you're sitting there at the site going through everything, everything done. I'll share an anecdote. What changed for me is the coordinator was, or the nurse was freaking out because I had high blood pressure when I was there, and it kept getting worse as the day went on. It's just what's happening. So I think it, and it was, I think also it showed what changed to show that as a sponsor, we were interested in what was happening with the patients and the site. So helping the site. And so I really appreciated that. We're the first patient, that piece. Now, did we have learn? We had learnings, I would say, at the patient level. We had site level learnings. We had protocol level learnings. You know, we found out that one of our scales had the wrong protocol at the bottom, right? Because we probably copied and pasted it from another study and didn't change. So we learned little things like that. You know, we did learn that, you know, having lots of tablets and shelves and shelves and shelves of equipment. Right, because everyone has their own ECG machine, right? So they had rooms of ECG machines, rooms of tablet. Like, so you just realize too, like the burden you put on a site in terms of the equipment that is necessary to conduct the procedures. And that's not even like my current situation where I have a drug that's refrigerated, right? So then you have, a different kind of potential burden at the site. So that was a good learning to be at the site. And the site was fantastic. The raiders were fantastic. Like how they moved us around, how we kind of went from room to room, when we had a break, where we couldn't have too long of a break because it was mental health again. But so I just think that was my biggest takeaway. Yes, we can make better protocols. Yes, we can make leaner protocols, and we should all try to do that. But really sitting in the shoes of a patient in a trial, I think was, for me, I hadn't been to a site in a while, so it was really, in that manner, it was really good.
So, this is a off the cuff question. I just thought about it. Imagine that you couldn't do a walkthrough. What would you advise somebody to do if they couldn't do a walkthrough that might still give them a little insight?
I mean, we're on meetings all the time. We have like group meetings on like this or on Zoom. Like you could probably go through and try to actually do it virtually. It wouldn't be the same, but you could at least say, okay, you're coming here now. What are you doing first? Oh, you're doing that. Oh, do you have your? So you could sort of talk through a visit. Maybe it's not as good, but it's at least something. And then you could make little notes. You said, oh, let's check to make sure the coordinator has her lab kits, or let's check this, or how long do you think it would? We spend a lot of time on how long it takes to do things like Madras and Hamilton and all that. So you could probably simulate that. I mean, I did the COAs. The COAs were sort of easy for me. I honestly don't have depression. But I was like, okay, that only took us a few minutes. Like, this wasn't as complicated a questionnaire as I thought it was going to be. So you could do some things, I think, virtually. It's just a little more planning and a little bit chunkier, like certain pieces of it, but I think it could be possible.
I mean, I was a pain in the neck for my study team leads, but I would ask them to try and estimate how much time it would take to go through the whole schedule of assessments for a visit, and then ask a site what they thought it was.
Excellent.
So, like you're saying, there are a lot of ways to get at this information. I think what I'm hearing from all the people who've joined today is we got to do this more. It's got to be
Yeah.
kind of our standard practice.
The medical writer wanted to
Yeah.
print out every single questionnaire and bring it to like an evidence team meeting and put it on the table and to ask them to complete it, right? Because all the HEOR photo, if you printed it all out, it would probably be a pretty big stack of paper that they'd have to then complete just to try to get people to sort of visualize, what are we asking our folks to do?
It's so esoteric until you actually roll up your sleeve. That's another story for another day. I want to say thank you so much, Rachel, for sharing your story and for being the person who was willing to learn by doing. This is the perfect example.
Thank
And
you.
I look forward to seeing you in November,
Thank you.
probably at, well, maybe both CNS Summit and at the annual meeting. And if you're going to DIA next week,
No, I
then
just got back from ADA. I'm not going to DIA. Others might be, though, right? On your call here. Excellent.
Jean and I will be there, and we always love seeing people in real life. That three-dimensional moment is special. Anything else you want to add there, Jean?
No, I think as I reflect on the conversation and the concepts around if you can't actually do it at the site, are there other alternatives? It kind of aligns with what we're thinking when it comes to hybrid trials anyway. We don't know what that flexibility could be. And maybe patients are being enrolled in a home care setting. Who knows where they're going to be? So that offers up even a broader opportunity for us to do these simulations where people are. If it's not going to be at the site, what have we learned from this site experience? I think it could quite simply, or not so simply, be extrapolated into the non-traditional site setting because that's equally important. And that's how we know we're going to increase access to clinical trials for patients. So much to be learned from this. And I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to listen. And I look forward to hearing how we can spread more about this really impactful, process that you've tried, and how can we get it to become more of a standard practice, but flexible enough, right, to not overburden the processes that we need to put in place. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that hour went fast.
It
So,
did. Really did.
wrap it up and send everyone on their happy day way, wherever you are and whatever time it is. Thanks for joining us. And keep watching for the next episode that drops here live or on your favorite platform. Thanks so much.
Take care. Have a great week, everyone.